Okay, continuing the interview now. You've arrived in Vietnam, and you said you came in at night.
Right.
And you said it was really dark.
Very dark for what I thought would be a major city down below, mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you see any firefights, any tracers, anything off in the distance that would alert you to where you actually were going?
Not really, no.
Okay.
It was just a peaceful landing.
Okay. How did you, when you got on the ground and got out, what were your first impressions of the country? Of course, it's at night again, but what were your first impressions?
Well, I can speak more to the next day.
Okay,
I mean,
sure.
There are certain smells associated with Vietnam and just the smells at large of that company, of that country. But you also are aware of how the military bases dealt with human waste. Yeah. And they were constantly burning, you know, waste on the outhouse affairs, went into a cut in half 50-gallon drum,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
And so this stuff was constantly on bases being burned, and that's literally one of those smells that you smell for the first time, and it's a smell you never really forget. I didn't know what it was like that first morning, you
mm-hmm.
know, up and out, and of course you're just engulfed with, you know, the heat of it all as
mm-hmm.
well,
mm-hmm.
And just all that's going on. But that smell of the burning is something that is just always there. Well, not in the field. I mean,
right.
I stayed mostly in the field, but it's just something you were always aware of.
Right.
And that's what kind of jumped on me that first morning, if you will. Just that
mm-hmm.
that particular aroma.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As we basically just went through an in-processing, a process so that we could get on to our assignments. So I don't know, I wasn't there, a day or two. Again, it's...
This is at Benoit?
This is at Benoit, somewhat, not overly memorable, just in and out, although I was able to visit on Benoit, where my brother had been the year previous, and
mm-hmm.
identified a swimming pool and a racquetball courts that he didn't share with me
mm-hmm.
about his time in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
But in short order, was off to Camp Anori,
okay.
Near Pleiku.
How did you get there, was it?
I want to say on a C-123.
Okay.
C-123 had the ability to get up, you know, a short runway
mm-hmm.
and get up in the air in a hurry, and I'm almost positive I was on a C-123.
Okay.
For that transport north to, or as they say, up country to Pleiku,
right, right.
or the 4th Division.
Right. Let me ask you a kind of overall larger question. Now that you're in country, what did you understand at the time of why the United States was in Southeast Asia? Were you aware of the bigger picture? Did you all discuss it? And what kind of internal conversation did you have with yourself about why the United States was even there?
You know, one of the main things commanders are in the process of commanding, one of the things that I strongly believe in is keeping the troops informed, and the welfare of the troops are kind of one and the same.
Mm-hmm.
After the mission comes welfare of the troops,
mm-hmm.
and then keeping the troops informed. I regret to say, at least in my own life, I was not very well indoctrinated to Vietnam, and certainly not really and truly to the political processes of what was going on in that country. And here I don't enjoy saying that, but I mean, here I am, an officer of the United States Army, and I must say to you, I wasn't that tuned to the larger picture, politically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I had no knowledge of the Vietnamese language. I mean, there was a language school for those who,
right.
who did that, but it was pretty much put in place in order to perform. And I don't mean that really that negatively, but I really was much lesser schooled than I think I should have been at large with information. Because I was a soldier, and I was primarily put there to fight the bad guys, and what more do you need to know?
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything's on a need-to-know basis, and I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to know at division level what they're doing. I only need to know at my company level, so I'm comfortable with that. But I don't think in my own mind, as I reflect back, that I had even an inkling of the understanding of the of what was going on politically. No.
Okay. Did that bother you?
At the time,
did you want to know the bigger picture?
Well, it frustrated. No question, it frustrated me at times. Mm-hmm. But again, I almost consider myself maybe a silly example, almost like a plow horse. I've been put in the field, and I've got my blinders on, and, mm-hmm. and here's my mission. I'm just mm-hmm. I'm just a lieutenant. Here's my mission, and all the other things are being taken care of by a higher order. And so I'm down here just doing my little part of it.
Okay.
But I would have, I know without question, I would have been better off in my mind if I had a better understanding of the larger picture.
Okay.
And I don't think that's all my fault of ignorance. We just weren't presented that. There's your rifle, boy.
Mm-hmm.
Go to war.
Tell me about that. How were you armed? What did you carry into the field with you when you reported out to Inari?
Well, at Inari, of course, was the division base camp, and mm-hmm. we spent, of course, we checked in with G1, got our specific assignments, mm-hmm. in my case, to the 2nd Brigade, Charlie Company of 2nd Battalion, 8th Infantry, as a rifle platoon leader.
Okay.
But there was a short, I don't know, 3 to 4 days, whatever it was, a short indoctrination period where we primarily was given our weapons. We were taken to the rifle range, of course, to sight them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in my case, I'm sure the rear area guys didn't, but as an infantry guy, we were taken on a little patrol, you know, in proximity of the division base camp wire, if you will, but yet out and made contact in the community of sorts around this division base camp. I remember seeing my first mountain yard people out there.
Mm-hmm.
Topless women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were mountain yards in their mm-hmm. loincloths and all.
Mm-hmm.
But that I can remember that early on because that was my first dealings or even visual of the indigenous people.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I came to know the mountain yard people because we worked in the highlands and they're primarily mountain people. I came to have a healthy respect for them at one village sometime later. I really was given the friendship bracelet from the chief, if you will, that meant a lot to me. I wore it proudly and came to know that they were honorable people. And they seemed somewhat, not fully understanding politics then, that they were kind of caught in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
They were a mountain tribal people that just were almost like the old slash and burn lifestyle.
You get that feeling then?
Yes, I'm speaking then.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had that time at base camp before I was actually assigned or taken out to my unit.
Okay. And when was that? Was it a couple days after?
2 or 3 days after we were, in my case, I'd say I was taken by a helicopter out to my platoon.
Let me ask you right there. You are the new leader for the platoon. These
correct.
Men do not know you.
Do not.
And you're going to step in and lead them in country. You're brand new in country in operations. How did you mentally prepare for that?
Through my training at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I was trained well to be a leader, a combat leader of the troops. Now, but what you just say, I may or not have mentioned it, these guys had already been in country about 9 months or so.
Right. Oh yeah.
When I arrived, so here mm-hmm. I am, as you just said, a brand spanking green behind the ears second lieutenant, and who am I to tell them anything? They have been in some major battles.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they trained together, they came over on the ship together, they've been together all that time, and now I'm the new guy.
Mm-hmm. Did you rely on the captain? Say, look, you got to tell me what to do here as far as indigenous to Vietnam into this specific area in country. How do you, yeah, I know how to set up a perimeter at Fort Benning, but how do you work a perimeter here? How do you do listening posts and outposts here? Was that the kind of thing that you were thinking and you're going through your mind, or did you just say, okay, here's what we're going to do?
Okay, the circumstance simplified that a little bit. I'll explain.
Okay.
But I never met my company commander yet, okay? What happened is my company, my platoon, if you will, was securing a rock quarry on a main road out of Pleiku, okay? I mean, it's out in the middle of nowhere, but they were actually the security force for an operating a rock quarry. The rest of the company was in the bush. And I did not meet my company commander until later.
He came out.
Believe
right. Okay.
Not even then. It was a little unusual because normally I would have been put right into the company. The company would be there in a total package.
Right.
But mine was separated at the moment. And so I went in and replaced a lieutenant. Literally, like in, we talk about changing guards out. He's in place. I come and take him, and then he leaves. I don't even remember who he was or if I met him. I don't even know. I mean, I replaced the lieutenant, but I don't have any memory of that other than, whammo, I'm at the rock quarry. Someone had to give me directions, I realized, of what my responsibility was. Certainly had a platoon sergeant there on site.
Right.
At my CP and my CP command bunker. But for the next week or 10 days, give or take, it simplified my indoctrination of sorts because we were in a relatively static position. And I had to run patrols out every day, and I put out elk listening posts and observation posts and things at night, of course. But it was it really did simplify my initial indoctrination on the ground,
right,
in the field, as platoon leader.
Okay. Do you have any action during that time when you're
not at this moment, but it's waiting.
Okay.
But no, this was a relative, as I say, it worked out nicely, in that sense of the word, to get attuned and meet my guys, etc.
How'd they react to you?
Again, I don't have any recollection of any animosity. Soldiers are. I can only speak about combat arms guys, but combat arms guys, for the most part, understand leadership, roles, chain of command, etc. Not that you can't have a bad experience and all those things, but I received no negativity that I was conscious of in any respect as I went through my little processes. Either that time or even when I took my rifle company 2 years later, I don't remember anything like that.
Okay.
He's the lieutenant, he's the boss. We'll follow him until he proves otherwise. He's the leader.
Okay.
And it didn't take long to prove.
Well, what happened?
Okay. As I say, I cannot remember actually meeting my company commander. And if I did, I'm so sorry to my own self that I can't remember that. But I don't. I just don't. And I just believe I did it. So, in my mind, the first time I met my company commander, we had an orders to leave the quarry, and we my platoon, through helicopters, flew into what was a burning village. What was happening is the system has said, okay, we're going to clear out this area. This is down in the Iodrang area. Okay, bad, bad place. And what they were trying to do is build essentially a free fire zone and then protect the villagers that were in those areas. So what the system was doing was moving them literally all the way up to this main highway that was west of Pleiku. What was called Tin City. They built houses, little shacks for them with tin.
Right.
They called it Tin City.
Right.
I remember. And so there was a term for that process, but they moved them out. So when I landed, as we landed, of course I went in to report to the battalion, to the company commander, Captain John Noble. And the village was on fire. It had been set on fire. I mean, there was no contact being made. It was just everything was burning and all the bamboo and this, that, and the other. I mean, it got my attention, okay, because it was very noisy, and really wasn't tuned to what all was going on. I didn't know that we weren't having a fight as we landed. I didn't know what was going on, per se.
Right.
So it was very dramatic. Reported to my captain.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he had been out in the field all this time while we've been sitting on our duff, so to speak, humping the bush. So within the first 10 or 15 minutes of being on the ground, Captain Noble laid out a 1 over 25,000 map and showed me this particular river and a trail, and assigned me a task of going down and setting up an ambush that afternoon for this trail junction.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in short order, that's what we did. And, I mean, this all happened probably within the course of a couple of hours from leaving there to landing and the burning and everything, and getting the mission to ambush and actually setting up the ambush. So, went down to the area that he had identified on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Identified the high avenue of approach. That's where I put my M60, one of the principles we learned. And put out, it wasn't because of the terrain and all, I couldn't emplace your classic L-shaped ambush.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little modification there.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the terrain. So we literally just gotten into place, and it's probably 1,400 hours or something in the afternoon, 15, I don't know. And nobody's eaten. So I know this is contradictory to an ambush, but we were going to do some eating here. I mean,
mm-hmm.
nobody'd eaten. And so help me, I had just taken off my ruck and gotten all my work done, and I had just leaned back against a tree. My RTO, my radio operator, was literally to my right shoulder. I had a can of sea rations in my hand, and I had just reached for my P-38 when the ambush sprang. And my RTO was immediately shot through the neck.
To see
it right here. Well, I am the new guy, but I'm also a trained warrior, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I had no problem reacting to this circumstance. So, I don't know, we returned fire and all the firing was going on.
Was your RTO killed instantly or did he live?
No, he was alive when I put him on the chopper.
Okay.
And I truly don't know. That was part of the uniqueness of the Vietnam War. He went to the rear. I had no more discourse or contact.
Right.
I truly don't know.
Let's take a break for a minute. I need to change
yes.
out the disc. Okay, let's go ahead and continue.
All righty, so the ambush was sprung. My RTO was shot. I don't know, he was our principal injury and may have been the only one. I want to say that there was another one or two, maybe slightly, but this was a serious injury here.
Right.
And so, with the design of the ambush site and the lay of the land and all, and trying to protect, because I'm still a new guy.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, during all this, now there's a lot of firing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I immediately start doing what a lieutenant's supposed to do. I crawl, because we're in essentially a perimeter of sorts, and I did a lot of crawling, directing fire, and all these different things. And while I was doing this, and I mean, there was a lot of bullets flying, okay? I came across an E6 hiding under a log, or beside a log, and I didn't have time to deal with that right now, other than I stopped and told him to get his ass in gear, and oftentimes I've regretted that I didn't shoot him. I don't mean that, okay? Because...
You don't mean that, or you do?
I do mean that. Jim Wheeler's definitions, okay, there are career soldiers, and they're what I call lifers. Life of being a negative.
Mm-hmm.
There are those guys that want to be a lifers or careerists, but they don't ever want to get shot at. It's a good, comfortable living and all this kind of stuff, a guaranteed paycheck, but don't shoot at me. And those are the guys I term lifers. This is Jim Wheeler's definition.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have a lot of use for them, taking up space for me. But he was hiding. I can see him as I look at you, Richard, lying right there. And the point being, most of these soldiers carried a U.S. in front of their service number. They were draftees. This guy was an E6 lifer. And I literally crawled right across him as I was doing my little thing. And now that contact is broken, needless to say, my greatest concern is to get this soldier out of here.
Mm-hmm.
But we are close to the river, and we're in we just don't have any place to land a chopper. So I found, as I'm doing, and this is happening so quickly, mm-hmm. and moving, and all, I did find very near where we are, there was a great big gully,
mm-hmm.
that just by its design had some freedom from the vegetation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so what I did is, because I still didn't know what size element we were dealing with, mm-hmm. or anything else, so
right.
much of it is unseen. I don't know. They found it very unique, because now these are my soldiers. They've done a lot of shooting.
Right.
And what I effectively did was I moved the perimeter intact and ultimately got it around the around this big gully affair.
Okay, let me note for the record here.
Yeah.
You're actually moving. You're holding your hands up, and you
right.
in a circular perimeter, and you actually just moved the entire
thing. I'm moving
thing.
It like I don't know 100 meters or whatever. I don't know the distance at this point, but trying to protect all
mm-hmm.
concerned
right.
in the wounded inside. And as I say, there may have been a couple more, but they were very minor versus the urgency was
right.
my RTO. That's what was really I remember the
mm-hmm.
most. But anyway, I found in that gully, I moved intact the entire perimeter, trying to protect all concerned with the injured inside,
mm-hmm.
and moved it over 50 to 100 meters, wherever this gully thing was, and secured that so that it looked like to me a chopper could at least come in. The skids were still going to, we had to lift him up. The skids, they couldn't come down to the ground,
mm-hmm.
but close enough versus the trees.
Right.
And so we were able to push him up into the chopper, and away he went. And that became, this is how much I'd been taught, because we weren't taught medals per se. Well, we mostly didn't write up awards. If we wrote up awards for everybody for every little firefight, we'd have spent half our time writing, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not going to ignore anybody that's earned an award. That's not
mm-hmm.
the point.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of like getting an award for doing your job. That's our job anyway. Above and beyond, yeah, we can deal with it. But out of that came my first Bronze Star V for Valor. What I learned after the award ceremony sometime later, we did have a formal presentation, is my guys said that should have been a Silver Star. And then when I reflect back, the reason, and it's okay, everything's okay. The reason it probably wasn't is because it was my first contact, brand new guy. Hey, let's don't get carried away here, kind of a humanistic thing.
Mm-hmm.
But so that was my first real day in the field. And that was, as I said earlier, I think it was either 7 straight days or 9, whichever it was, of some kind of absolute contact with the enemy.
Starting that day,
my first real day in the field, after, you know, aside from the
mm-hmm.
quarry. And it was always my platoon was second platoon, and every time there was a fight, they'd say saddle up second. You may have heard that term, but saddle up second.
Mm-hmm.
My guys knew what to do and how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so within the next, another little thing I remember is in the next day or two, we had, because we're working as a company now.
Okay, mm-hmm.
we're together as a company and operating independently as platoons, but still basically together, and we sent out a water run. That's where the platoon collects up all the empty canteens, 3 or 4 guys, put them on a belt, whatever, and they
mm-hmm.
go down to the water line and
mm-hmm.
fill up canteens. So on this particular day, that had taken place, and they got pinned down. There were bad guys, and turns out some of them were trees. They were snipers, and so saddle up second. So what basically happened is this was a great big old burned out, blown out field, if you
mm-hmm.
will, area. And then there was a heavy tree line, and down below was the river where our guys were in this little fight. And so, but we had fire coming back at us as well, automatic weapons fire. And so, second platoon, we were there first, and I moved my guys online, and then I'm using arm and hand signals to maneuver my people. Well, what I didn't realize, and what I didn't know either, was I didn't know what the sound of a bullet sounded like passing your head until just fixing to happen. And what else I didn't realize at the moment was there were a couple of snipers in the trees shooting back this way. And what they had, I can see it now, is he's up in the tree, and this is a fully blown out field, if you will. And it's just a panoramic view of us coming forward. Well, it isn't too hard to pick out the lieutenant because he's the guy doing all of this stuff.
Right.
And there's a radio guy by him.
Right.
So I had moved forward and jumped down behind a tree, a burned out stump thing, and had moved my guys to where now. And there's one a guy, his name was Johnson. I remember him doing so well. And this is in contrast to that E6 I just mentioned. By the way, I sent him to the rear and got rid of him. The guy that hit
him.
Yeah, the
guy that was hiding, right?
Yeah, back there. But he was out of my unit, and who knows what that company commander did with him. But in conversely speaking, here's this was a black soldier, E4, took command over here because part of my guys were out of my view with the tree line here, and it was just an example of a typical American youth drafted into the United States Army, giving his all over here, totally on his own initiative, basically, okay? I just remember him doing some stuff over there that I couldn't get to. But my next time to move, after I got everybody forward, I stood up, of course, for my little stump, and I zing, 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 zing. I don't know how many, and I didn't fully realize if I realized, I mean, I knew what I heard, but I didn't understand it. I'm just, you know, I was the perfect statistic to die that early as a lieutenant, okay? Not through any fault of my own. I mean, I'm having to do what not like I was doing something stupid.
No.
It's just
you're doing
casualty of war or early on, as they say. The first 3 months and the last three are by far the worst times. Here you don't know enough to know the difference. You think you know more than you do. But anyway, when I moved, that's when I had my first experience of bullets passing me by, you know, however close, and they really do pop like a cap.
When they pass you.
Yeah, they do. And I mean, a couple of guys, could have been one, but he had me zeroed, and thank God he flunked a marksmanship, because as I look back and realize what he did, he had that panoramic view and just a perfect way to shoot out there at me. But God has smiled upon me more than once in my life. And so that was just like the very next day. And then in the same window of time, we had some South Vietnamese soldiers with us. And I'd heard stories of how poor they were, as soldiering.
Where did you hear the stories?
Just through, informally, okay,
right.
Just the troops talking.
Right.
Their experience over the past 9 months, 10 months, or what have you, their experience with them, and whatever I might have heard back in the rear as we're going out, you know. Be aware, be cautious. The irony being, here it is, their country, their soldiers, they're supposed to be fighting, and yet they lean so heavily on us. So, call it the next day, it was in the same window of time. We were, and this is still in the I Dring Valley, okay, which is essentially where we were soldiers, you know, took place. Because there was a place down there, not that I did it often, but I was able to do it more when we went to APCs. I could get a fight anytime I wanted it in this one little area. They were just always down there. But on this third day, call it, Richard, we're moving basically on that. There's no contact. We're just moving along, searching.
What were your orders? Search?
It's basically search, S&D. You just search. Cloverleaf, whatever the circumstance of the surroundings and all the above, whatever, maybe even intelligence you have. But for all intents and purposes, our mission was search and destroy. here's your AO, here's your area of operations, lieutenant or captain.
Mm-hmm.
Check it out. However you want to divide it up with your squads, platoons,
mm-hmm.
and all that. Yes, sir.
Okay.
But we were moving. Again, these things are coming back, and we were moving through this area, and all of a sudden, this little this tree line to our front, you know, we were in bush and stuff, but there was a little clearing. And
How far ahead of you?
Oh, it wasn't 50 meters, give or take, because we were staggered, you know, a different way. But we had Arvin. It wasn't like they were on point, but we had Arvin up in front of us, at least in my little sector. There were some Arvin soldiers up there.
Did you put them up there? Was that your choice to put them first?
Essentially, because they were kind of attached to us, maybe at the company level, but for this given day, there was some Arvin in my little area that I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's another platoon here and another platoon here. Well, weapons fire came out of the tree line to our direct front. And I saw it with my own eyes. You should fall down as close to the ground as you can, if you will, in general terms, and return fire.
Right.
Here they come.
The Arvin.
Running right before my eyes.
They turned and ran back.
Turned and ran, just like I'd been told they'd do.
Mm-hmm.
Turned and ran. So now they can get shot in the back.
Mm-hmm.
At least give them something to think about. But I witnessed it with my own eyes right in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
They turned and they ran.
Now, was this a typical experience with you with the Arvin?
I didn't have a lot of experiences with the Arvin.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, I just say that as a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't outside of this time frame, as a general rule, I never had any. I was pure, if you will, conventional forces.
Mm-hmm.
We had interpreters sometimes, uninterpreted, but not just a pure Arvin rifleman.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have that experience either time around to speak of. But in this instance, I saw it with my own eyes.
Let me ask you.
Certainly.
You came across a few days before your own man, an American, hiding. And here you see these two South Vietnamese soldiers turning and running. What was your inclination? Were you in a position to discipline them immediately? Or because of the fire, you needed to take care of the fire? What was your reaction to that?
Okay. Well, first of all, we needed to return fire and get on with the task at hand.
Right.
I cannot... I'm pretty confident. I don't remember any personal discourse with them. I'm sure they were a company asset, and that would have been the captain's responsibility to deal with,
right.
The old man, because I cannot, I don't have any memory of dealing with
mm-hmm.
them directly.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure, no question they were dealt with, but certainly at the company level versus the platoon.
Okay.
But these same guys, and you know, I don't have how many we had. We had a couple of three right in my little sector. But this just adds insult to injury. So we kill some of the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then the Arvins were told to bury them. And so they stayed behind in a little force to bury these guys.
Yeah, sorry, Colonel, let me interrupt you again.
That's all right.
Did you go inspect the bodies? Is this the first time you'd seen the enemy dead?
Well, no, I'd seen some already with the
from
other...
From the previous ambush.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to that, first time seeing the enemy and seeing him dead?
There was nothing repulsive about it to me. They were the enemy. It could just as easily be me. I'm a Christian person, but yet at the same time, I was not bothered that, oh my goodness, here's a dead person, a God rest his soul thing. It was just very matter-of-fact to me.
Mm-hmm.
Firefight, dead enemy, better he than I.
Okay.
Let's press on.
Okay.
Nothing, I mean, yeah, you take it in. You know, I mean, this is a human,
mm-hmm.
regardless. But it's very fleeting. You, there are too many other
right.
things to do. You can't sit and
right.
dwell on it. And I was not demonstrably emotionalized negatively or positively.
Mm-hmm.
It was just more of a matter of fact. Just the word.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't implying at all.
No.
I mean to imply that you should have had any other reaction.
No, I understand that.
I just wanted to know how you had reacted. And, okay, this is business. Let's move on.
That's well said. And as I say, I got on all right with this stuff, if you will. I mean, I just was able to deal with it pretty straight up. I wasn't ever really too bothered by it.
Okay.
But the irony was, so after this, we've got some dead guys. Mm-hmm. Okay, you are and bury them. We've got to go in and sweep the area. We've got to do our work because you all guys aren't. So to add insult to injury, we of course had passed on through and went on however far we went. But at some point, well past that area, mm-hmm. we set up a night logger, right? Set up for the night,
mm-hmm.
which we did. But then, as fate would have it, so to speak, we passed back through that area the next day. And here's an arm sticking up out of the ground. Here's a leg. The point I'm making, these guys didn't even bury them good. Okay? So help me. Strange. Now, this was not... I took this in. I mean, this was strange. I mean, here you are walking. Mm-hmm. Whoa, there's an arm sticking up.
Mm-hmm.
So help me. So these guys didn't even get that right. I didn't come here to pick on them, but those happened. I saw it.
Right.
The gospel. And that's what happened.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you. Exactly what your experiences were with the Arvin. That's interesting. Your first couple weeks mm-hmm. out in the field and country, and this is your experience with them. How did that make you feel? The United States is there, in essence, defending South Vietnam and helping them fight their fight. For better or for worse, whatever the reasons, political, but there you are in the field and you're seeing the South Vietnamese turn tail and run. Did you have thoughts of like, whoa, what's going on here? This is, why am I in their country if they're not going to fight? Or did you just say, this is business, let me just carry forward?
No. The former is how I felt and how we talked about it to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
Very disappointed. Not at all happy. No doubt, demonstrably, demonstrably upset at the audacity of these guys to do that. Because, just as you just described, Richard, I'm here to help you, and yet you're not doing your part. You're not doing your fair share.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was quite disturbing. No question about it. What can I do about it? Not a whole lot, of course, but yet it was very disturbing, and we talked about it to some degree at large. You know,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm. After your initial first few days in contact, did you feel like your men held you in a little higher esteem? They saw how you would behave under fire, how you would react. Had you proven yourself, do you think, to your men by this point? Or did you need more time?
Well, I think that... certainly, that was happening, and I had something, so to speak, to prove, because, as I've said, these were battle-proven soldiers. These guys mm-hmm. had been through an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
But in short order, the new lieutenant had been through his fair share in a similar fashion.
Well, you won the Bronze Star in your first action.
First one, yeah. But... but again, I'm just getting on with the flow of things. I'm not spending a lot of time thinking too much about it. But yes, I mean, no question, subconsciously, if not consciously, I'm certainly wanting my troops to understand that I care for them. Their welfare is of my utmost concern.
Right.
And I want to show them, I'm not making a plan to show them, but just as events unfold, mm-hmm. that I am, in fact, capable of leading them,
mm-hmm.
and that they will be well cared for under my care mm-hmm. or leadership, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that unfolded somewhat naturally through no planned effort. I could have flunked the course. Some people flunked the course, but I stood up under fire. I did,
okay.
And that worked.
Can you describe your uniform, what you carried in the field, your equipment, your weapons?
Well, certainly, fatigue-wise, it was just the basic old jungle fatigue mm-hmm. that you know and have seen.
Mm-hmm.
We got to change clothes ever so often. There was no regularity to when we changed clothes. I probably started out with my own shirts thinking that. But then once you threw them in, you just wore whatever came back from the big wash. It was so that's when we just took off of our personalized cross rifles and lieutenant bars. You needed those on your collar, of course. although I suppose I could have done without them. They knew who I was, but that was only proper understanding.
Right.
But so your clothing came in just like sea rations and everything else, and water. When you got a change of clothes, you were just happy to get a change of clothes, and they were just fatigues in a bag that you grabbed and put on. And you mentioned at some point in our conversation earlier today, I'll even go to the underwear level. We just, as a rule, didn't wear underwear because, again, in the dry season, you were wet so much of the time from pure sweat. You were wet anyway, and in the monsoon season, you were wet. And I suppose we considered the underwear just something that would perhaps chafe you, just an extra something there that didn't need to be there under the conditions. Plus, there was probably a shortage as much as anything else. We just, no big deal.
Okay. How about socks?
Now, socks were very much more important, of course, both seasons as well, because even though you're not in the wet season, obviously you need dry socks, but in the dry season, your feet still, you're perspiring so much that you gotta enforce, and you used your medic, your old doc, you used him to really enforce that. Now, you use your chain of command as well, but very important to keep the feet clean and well, because that was our travel.
Right.
So that was just our basic undergarments, was that, and your basic jungle boots. You always had your towel around your neck was imperative, because again, you're just constantly wet either way, and so the towel was a major part of your rucksack, and your rucksack, of course, being your pack. You know, I've never weighed my rucksack, but, you know, the average numbers that I've heard, and I like to think I knew at one time formally as an officer, that was around 80 pounds. 60 to 80 pounds was the, and I've heard 80 more than any number, was about the average weight of a given individual's rucksack. But, you know, you add on to that, on top of that, the poor RTO, the radio telephone operator, he had to carry his radio on top of that, and then you had to carry extra batteries. I mean, this is on top of your basic, you know. And so we spread around the batteries to help out, as we did with other things, because believe it or not, as simple as it sounds, you know, not everybody carried a razor. You might carry a razor and you carried this. You know, because you did everything you could to simplify and lighten your load. And of course, we didn't have to carry, or we shouldn't have with us, and forget deodorant. And there's a tactical reason for deodorant and aftershave, even though we were required and should shave every day for a lot of reasons. And they, you don't use aftershave, because that's just another thing that can, you literally could smell the enemy in the field, and I'm sure they could smell us. Without
you could smell them.
Yeah, there was.
How could you smell them?
There was something in the air. Their smell emanated in the air if they were in proximity.
Would you have to be downwind, or was it even stronger?
And I'm not talking like it was something that you could just color in and see all the time.
Right.
But there were those instances where, in proximity of the enemy, either doing a fight after a fight or whatever it may have been, there was a smell. It was there. I guess you'd say their body smell. And some people call it the smell of fear. You know, I've heard that term.
I have. How can you describe that smell? Do you remember the smell today?
I dare say, if I smelled it at this moment, I could probably say, yeah, that's it. But that isn't. But it was just a dull, dank. Nothing that I could really relate it to. I can't even say it. I don't know that I could even say bad odor, bad body odor.
Right.
I don't even know if you call it that.
It was just a smell.
A smell.
Unique?
It was a unique unto itself.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Did it evoke a physiological reaction, that smell?
Yeah, it heightened your alertness. It was kind of a warning order kind of a thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, there's something here.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about the other equipment you carry. Obviously, canteen and What else?
Well, as I say, with your rucksack, you know, of course, in your rucksack you had your personal torches, as limited as they were, and certainly your sea rations. In later times, we got LERP rations versus sea rations were good because mainly they were different, but anything gets old. But obviously, a lot easier to carry than cans.
Mm-hmm. What was your favorite sea rat?
Beans and Franks.
Beans and Franks? Not ham and lima beans?
No! Nobody eats ham and lima beans.
I asked that on purpose.
I know. Yeah. I hear you.
Okay.
That's one that you couldn't give away.
Ham and MFs, right? They were called ham and MFs. I've heard them referred to. They were so
bad. They were. And I, you know, in Tennessee, I ate my share of lima beans growing up, and I tried the sea ration lima beans, but they were not good.
Okay.
So that's cute. But you never knew because, you know, when we shared a case of sea rations, mm-hmm. obviously if you open the top, each individual is stamped with what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But to make it fair, you always turned it over.
Right.
I mean, you open it up and turn it over and pull the box off, so now the bottoms are there, and so you just pick a box, because there were those favorites, beans mm-hmm. and Franks being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
There was an egg thing that was pretty bad, too. And I'm a picky eater, so we do what we have to do. Garlic salt and hot sauce were, you know, staples in the field, because mm-hmm. anything you can do to alter the taste a little mm-hmm. bit. And I did a lot of peanut butter and jelly and cracker, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of made up your rucksack.
Okay.
Aside from that, you couldn't carry enough water. I mean, everybody was required to carry however much it had been, 2 or 3 canteens. We even went to 2-quart bladders at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But I've got pictures of me with, you know, D-rings, all, you know, with canteens here, there, and yon, because you couldn't carry enough water, especially during the dry season, because more than once I've gone to a blue line on my map to get water, only to find it's dried up. And then you wore your bandoliers, your M16 mm-hmm. 5.62 magazines. Again, that you're required to carry so many, you want to carry more, that was your prerogative. Certainly on your pistol belt you had your standard ammo pouches for that, but generally we carry them in bandoliers, and your ammo pouches were used to carry something else, maybe some kind of pogey bait, we call it, you know, some kind of little snack or something there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course you had your first aid pouch there,
mm-hmm.
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, and of course the helmet and helmet liner and steel pot, although when I had my recon, I let them skate and we wore berets in the field, but that's another story yet.
Okay. What kind of weapons?
That's why my weapon, in my case, I was so grateful for this. Most everyone, of course, carried the M16 rifle, no question. And we had, of course, the grenade launcher, the M79,
mm-hmm.
Was carried, as well as the M60.
Mm-hmm.
M60 machine gun, and of course, the assistant gunner had to carry extra ammo as the assistant gunner for the M60. It seemed like invariably, although I had a particularly one big by a guy named Kingsbury, name of my high school, carried the M60. In fact, that story I was telling you about all the leeches,
yes,
he carried the 60 on that particular recon. But seemed like little guys forever was carrying that M60. And it's a heavy weapon.
Uh-huh.
No longer in the active system, I was told at Fort Benning mm-hmm. last month. But it was a wonderful weapon. In my case, getting back, I carried the AR-15, the CAR-15, which had the folding stock. It looked like an M16, but it was a much smaller version, and then of course the stock would extend out,
mm-hmm.
but carrying it through most all the time, you know, you always had it over your neck and
mm-hmm.
always in the ready position. Of course I had the stock in,
mm-hmm.
and so it, for me, it was just, for anyone it would carry one, but mostly officers at that time, it was just a much smaller weapon, so a lot easier to get around
mm-hmm.
and deal with than the M16.
Right. Did you have a sidearm?
We had, of course, grenades. I didn't mention the grenades,
right.
But the M26 fragmentation grenades.
Mm-hmm.
And smoke. We always carried smoke, various colors, purple, yellow, what have you. Certainly red is only for a bad time.
Mm-hmm.
And what did you just ask me?
Sidearm.
Sidearm. I'm going to have to tell a story.
Okay.
The 45, which was your basic sidearm, we didn't really have in the field. The M6, I mean, we needed firepower. I think the only one, I mean, there's lots of crazy stories about the 45, but a sidearm, in general terms, wasn't going to be of much use, in general terms. So as a rule, no sidearm. But at one point, we were operating off of LZ Oasis, which was a brigade size LZ just southwest of Camp Lenore, brigade size LZ with I don't know how much, maybe a battalion of artillery. Anyway, I was securing that. We had now gone from straight leg. We had a conversion. We were converted to mechanized before I took the recon platoon. Mm-hmm. So in short order, at some point, we actually got M113s or armored personnel carriers. So my recon platoon job also became a scout platoon job. But we still operated mostly on the ground. We're, I mean, mm-hmm. they could get us to some point, but we still had to work or walk. And
when was that transition?
It was probably in June. Probably in June. '67. Not too long after I had joined them. Because mm-hmm. we came out of the field specifically to get our APCs. Mm-hmm. I forgot where I was going, Richard.
The sidearm story.
So there we were on an LZ Oasis, and rumor had it that there was an Australian officer in Pleiku who was there as an advisor. Mm-hmm. He had lots of Browning, Belgium-made Browning 9mm still in the Cosmoline, and he was trying to build a force there with the Arvin or Rough Puffs or whatever, but he needed M16s. And so, sitting around my CP, my command carrier one day, this was mentioned, and just in passing, and I said, without even thinking about it, I said, man, I'd sure like to have one of those pistols. Well, that's all the lieutenant, I didn't do it consciously, believe mm-hmm. me, mm-hmm. but that's all the lieutenant really needs to say, mm-hmm. because his troops look after him. Mm-hmm. So about 3 days later, I come out of my command bunker to go over to my APC or whatever, and sitting right at the commander's hatch was a brand new Browning Belgian made 9mm pistol.
Wow.
And almost on the same day, the artillery battery commander, the captain mm-hmm. at the battalion briefing, reported his troops missing M16s. So, my boys. See, our guys, we never leave our rifles ever for a minute, but the artillerymen, you know, it's just a secondary thing to them. They're leaving their rifles
right,
around.
Right. They lost them.
What can I say?
Yeah, okay. So did you carry that 9mm with you the whole time?
I carried that the rest of my time.
Okay, how about the second tour? Did you bring it? Well, yeah. You couldn't bring it back with you. Were you able to take it home with you? Okay. You still have it?
I regret that I don't. I made an error, and I traded it, and it was the dumbest thing I ever did, but I'm sorry you asked that question. I just made a stupid error and traded it for a Western pistol, and it was the dumbest thing I ever did. So I regret that I don't have that pistol to give to my son.
Okay.
But we have to live with our
right.
choices.
Right, of course. What was your favorite weapon?
My R-15.
Okay.
My 15.
Was there anything that you... I'm sorry, was there anything that you did not have that you really wanted to have? And you just spoke about the 9mm, but was there anything else that you said, okay, I want this?
No, because that's, you know, we go on rock and roll. Our little weapons served us well. I mean, there was always the controversy about the AK-47 was far superior in the field environment to the 5.56, you know, the 7.62, the 5.56. Mm-hmm. And there's a certain case to be made for that. Mm-hmm. I've seen many AK-47s after a battle, and not that they were naturally dirty as a rule. Any soldier's going to keep his weapon clean, but I've seen them in pretty dire straits, and they were they were steadily pumping lead at us. You know, so they held up well in the field.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take much to lock up an M16.
Mm-hmm.
It really did. Mm-hmm. And then there's the old studies that I've seen in film about the tumbling 5.56 when it once it hits foliage and goes into a tumbling affair. Therefore, it doesn't have the hitting power
mm-hmm.
that it should have because of that. But I think all told, it did as well. It performed its role in Vietnam all told.
Okay.
So those, you know, those were our basic weapons. Obviously, we at night we put out trip flares and we set out our claymores. There's nothing more damaging and scary and to pop off a claymore mine at the bad guys. It's powerful. We even carried some Willie Pete White Phosphorus grenades, mainly for tunnel bunker work and those kinds of things.
What do you mean bunker work?
Well, we go into or maybe a tunnel complex and you want to, they're just not going to voluntarily come out.
Right.
But throw some white phosphorus grenade down there. And I mean, you could throw down a concussion grenade and kill them if they're there, but this way that this would kind of generate them, cause them to make an appearance.
Mm-hmm. Would you take them prisoner most of the time or would you kill them?
I have more than once not fired. When I mentioned earlier about the movement of the villages out of our area,
yes.
So that especially my second tour, we had essentially a free fire zone.
Mm-hmm.
But I value life, and I more than once. Disallowed myself and our my troops to fire because we weren't quite sure. I mean, if we were quite sure, there was never a hesitance.
Mm-hmm.
But as I spoke to you, I just saw two khaki guys in a tree line. We were in our APCs, and I know pretty much they were bad guys. But there was a question in my mind. We may not have hit them. They were pretty far away, but the 50 cal will reach out there, of course. But they probably lived today because I made a decision. I wasn't sure. I can't remember all of the circumstances,
mm-hmm.
but I just didn't want to arbitrarily
mm-hmm.
kill. I had, on my second tour, I had one of my guys got jumpy and shot to movement, and he shot off the thumb of one of his fellow soldiers, you know. Dum, dum, dum. Dum, dum, dum. And he was a guitar player at that, his left thumb. But, so I had to be aware of what was going on,
mm-hmm.
and not just arbitrarily
mm-hmm.
fire. Even in a free fire zone, I mean, within reason, you've mm-hmm. got to be reasonable
mm-hmm.
in my mind about it.
Because
mm-hmm. you never know if someone's gotten out of line, they're circling back, they got lost.
Mm-hmm.
And on occasion we had, as I mentioned, our interpreters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they are South Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
and I don't care to kill them if I can help them.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about the enemy. What are your general impressions about who you were fighting?
I have to separate from what I know today versus then.
Sure.
I really didn't know a whole lot about them.
Tell me how you felt.
Okay. Mm-hmm. To me, In my little world,
mm-hmm.
they were the bad guys. I was aware that the North Vietnamese Army
mm-hmm.
was quite a bit more disciplined, without question, than the Oregon Army.
You'd heard this?
I'd heard this, and now I had seen it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you take into account all that they did just to get there, that alone was impressive. Not that I didn't meet some impressive Oregon, but my time with them were limited.
Mm-hmm.
I remember meeting a Dawi, I forget his name. Anyway, he was mostly an unseen enemy, though, right? Rarely did you see this guy. So he was an unknown face,
mm-hmm.
and I just didn't know a lot about him other than he was an opposing force, and it was my job to take him out.
Mm-hmm.
I had no compassion for him. He was an unseen face to begin with. And it was one of those, either he kills me or I kill him first kind of a scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where I was with that. We were fortunate in my area of operations with that in mind. You know, the MVA were basically professional soldiers, if you will, mm-hmm. just to make the point, versus the VC.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the VC had less equipment and that sort of thing, so they had to go to unconventional situations.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what I like about it, I've said many times, I'd rather go do a pickup. I live in Valley Ranch, and the Cowboys are right there. Well, I'd much rather play a pickup weekend touch football game against the Dallas Cowboys, a mix, but I mean with the Cowboys versus the guys that never played ball.
Mm-hmm.
My analogy, if you will, is they know what to do when, but the guy that's never played is always in your way and screws everything up. And try to make this clear. So in the case of fight, in that scenario, mm-hmm. fighting the NBA, it was a pretty straight up conventional kind of deal.
Mm-hmm. You can employ better what you had learned and been trained with. And
we're going to fight on like terms.
Mm-hmm.
But the VC were kind of off the chart in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm working towards is one of the things that, because of where we operated in the Highlands, always just we weren't ever around really population areas. So we weren't faced with VC as a rule. And in the same breath, we weren't faced, generally speaking, although I've got a pretty good star here to say otherwise, we weren't faced, for the most part, with booby traps like the 1st Division around Saigon, as an example. And we were taught a lot of that before coming over. Booby traps was really, I remember that in particular being mm-hmm. preached to us a lot because, you know, you don't just open a door, you don't just pick up something, and I've heard many horror stories. You know, of a battalion S3, there's been a firefight, and the commander comes in, and, oh my God, look, there's a rifle over there, or whatever it may be. Let me go get that for you. And that's the thing that you're taught time and again, and more than once, the guy goes to grab it, and it was booby-trapped, and blows him away.
Did you ever see any of that?
I never, that kind of an accident, no.
Mm-hmm.
In my second tour, I lost some boys. One boy on his 21st birthday lost his legs to a booby trap. Beautiful young man on his 21st birthday. So I'm just saying. So as a rule, we weren't faced with that, especially in my first tour with the unconventional stuff mm-hmm. in the way of booby traps. As a general rule,
mm-hmm.
it was more of a straight up fight with mm-hmm. the NBA.
What would you say would be the strengths and weaknesses of the NBA if you had to gauge them?
Boy. Well, their strengths are dedication to the cause, their ability to hit and run, and I mean they definitely performed well, the NBA. I'll just give you another example, if I may, a dramatic example of that. And again, the majority of my time was against those guys versus, as I said, the black pajama guys mm-hmm. we think of as the VC. Their weaknesses would be kind of internal to themselves as far as their lines of communication and logistics. That's an internal problem to them.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess aided us in a sense. But as far as just the actual performance of battle,
mm-hmm.
these guys were dedicated and good at what they did within the means of what they had. One example of that, we were operating southwest of Duco, which is there's Pleiku. Southwest of Pleiku, as I remember it, is Campanari,
mm-hmm.
and then there's the LZ Oasis, and then when you go on out that road, you go to a special forces camp called Duco
mm-hmm.
before you get to Cambodia. And then south of Duco is an old camp called Play Me. And between the two was a pretty good area to deal with, right near the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
And we were operating out in that area. And on one afternoon, I patrolled a particular area until mid to late afternoon in this particular area,
mm-hmm.
you know, say 300 yards square, whatever kind of a place. I worked it. And then I came down this road, and we were night loggered in our APCs in a company size night logger.
Mm-hmm.
And sometime in the night, I don't remember the time, all of a sudden it was like the 4th of July. And from the general area where I had just been till late afternoon, there were they were firing. It was the bad guys firing into Duco, which was a little special forces camp. It's an Arvin camp with special forces advisors. So we're here. They're firing very. I mean, this wasn't not even 200 meters, probably. Honestly, right here where mm-hmm. these guys were firing into Duco special forces camp.
Mm-hmm.
With recoilless rifles, etc. Well, being the hard-charging lieutenant that I was immediately down to the Captain Noble's command track, chomping at the bit, because I knew exactly where these guys were. And I'm truly, literally begging Captain Noble
mm-hmm.
to allow me to gather up my platoon and head up there.
Mm-hmm.
Either on foot or on APC, whichever. Because I just can't stand it. I just know almost exactly where they are
mm-hmm.
based on the flashes and,
right.
and all. He, being the wizened old commander, didn't say no, but hell no. Okay? But once again, he saved my life. Because the attack wasn't so much about Duco, it was about the ambush. This is the smartness of the MVA. And I'm going to describe it. It was all set up for me, for Jimmy Wheeler, to come running up the road and to kill all these Americans. This was something of a feint, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because at first light, I got to go up there. And I don't remember the exact numbers now, but I'm telling you, Richard, as I said, I was there till late. Relatively late afternoon
mm-hmm.
on the day before, and this started happening sometime in the night. I don't know if it,
mm-hmm.
whatever night. I got up there, and there was an old road that went up there. I mean, we didn't normally you don't walk on roads and trails. I fully practice that, but where we would have come up if we'd have done the APCs, would have come up this road,
right?
And they had dozens and dozens of fighting positions in place. Okay?
All along the road.
There wasn't one hole there when I was there that afternoon. Right? I never saw a bad guy. I never had any hint. I mean, I'm looking for them, but that's just it. You mostly looked.
Mm-hmm.
But sometime between the time I left and say 10 o'clock in that, whatever it was, I mean, I'm talking about multiples of holes, and I'm talking, and they could dig a hole with their little old entrenching tool by the numbers. I mean, slick, just not just a sloppy hole.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nice professional holes.
Mm-hmm.
But they had dug emplacements for automatic weapons, you know, not just a weapon, but I mean, automatic weapons, a whole bit, all down what we call a high speed of approach, which we would no doubt would have. Big bad Americans come rolling up on our APCs and RPGs would have blown us all out, etc. And I forget, I don't know, I mean, this went on forever. I mean, I'm talking about, I don't want to state a number, I mean, we're talking, had to be 100 holes. I mean, I'm serious. Dug in that short amount of time and everything in place,
mm-hmm.
so everything's canted towards us,
right.
but they're firing over here. Just waiting for us mm-hmm. to come. But
mm-hmm.
the old wise commander, see?
Mm-hmm.
And they were gone. Right back across the border, because we were right up on the Cambodian border there. Gone. So.
And that's the NVA.
That's the NVA, and that's how impressive, I mean, that's how impressive they could be.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they obviously were watching me patrol that day. So, somehow, you know, they had me in their sights.
Mm-hmm.
maybe could have attacked us or, you know, generated a contact, but that would have defeated what their real mission
right.
was.
Right.
Their lieutenant might have wanted to do that, but their captain said, no, leave Wheeler alone. Let's wait till tonight mm-hmm. and do what the heck we're supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I was told at one point, I was told at one point, this is totally unofficial, please,
mm-hmm.
that there was a price on my head down in that valley. Because I ran it a lot. I was the recon guy, and once we got our APCs, we spent a lot of time down in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told, informally,
mm-hmm.
that there was a price on my head at one point.
Okay.
I hadn't thought of that lately either.
Okay.
But
what about the Viet Cong, their strengths and weaknesses?
I really didn't have any real dealings with the Viet Cong,
mm-hmm.
per se.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would probably, not having had any, all I could probably say is what I know today and maybe what I've read, but I didn't have any real direct. There was one time, though, they were probably Viet Cong. Well, we were dealing with Viet Cong because of where we were. That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is still in the same time frame.
Mm-hmm.
I'm recon platoon leader, and we've been sent south to secure a little temporary fire base,
mm-hmm.
probably for 105s, well south, almost down to Bambi Tuit area. And so it was a new area for, I mean, it was well south of where we normally operated,
mm-hmm.
and it put us into something of an indigenous circumstances with indigenous people and,
right.
You know, fairly near a little village, because I got my picture, I even liked horses in. I got a picture on a little horse
mm-hmm.
then, and this, that, and the other. But one day, I'm sitting in my APC command post, and we had a reporter from the Ivy Lee's newsletter from the division.
Mm-hmm.
Just happened to be there. And it was mid-morning, and it was time for me to send out a patrol. And so my primary radio operator, whose father was the mayor of Indianapolis, if I remember correctly, because he's my personal radio operator, so he didn't go out, you know,
mm-hmm.
with the other
right.
squad. They did their own. He begged me to go out on a patrol that morning. Literally, he wanted a break. You know, we'd been stationed there a few days,
mm-hmm.
and he wanted to go out. He was an interesting guy, Creech. So I succumbed, and I said, okay, you know, grab your radio and take off. Have a ball. So I'm sitting here in my APC, my radios are right here,
mm-hmm.
and talking to this reporter, just whatever, and Creech comes on the radio, and his voice is inflected,
mm-hmm.
and he is one worried individual. Now he uses I don't remember the exact call signs, but for all intents and purposes, I'll call me Recon 6 and call him Charlie 6. So the point is, he was using
right.
his proper radio
right.
procedures, but he called and he says, you know, Recon 6, Recon 6, Charlie 6, over. And I heard him. He was
mm-hmm.
excited. I said, Roger, you know, Recon 6, over. He said, there's a big element to our front.
A big what?
Element.
Okay.
Well, with his voice level and the fact that we weren't in our normal area of operations to kind of know what's going on, I need, and this is all instantaneous, of course, I needed to know whether we were dealing with the NVA or the VC to react in one sense of the word. So but as I'm going through this in my mind immediately to ask him that question, I see Genghis Khan's hordes coming. I mean, with his voice, and I'm like, we're
right.
talking about six or seven guys out there, right?
How long have you been gone?
Oh, I don't, you know, in the 30 or 45 minutes, something like, you know, just a short,
mm-hmm.
just kind of running,
mm-hmm.
little, we'll make sure no guys are getting in too close to us, just a short patrol. And so I literally saw these hordes, but I didn't know what uniform to put on them yet, but I saw these hordes of bad guys
mm-hmm.
coming at my half a dozen guys.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all happening in the same as I said. So I immediately came back and I says, well, describe them to me. Because I needed to know, are they in khakis or are they
mm-hmm.
in black or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
He says, he came back and he says, well, it's big and gray and has big floppy ears. Well, I went from here to here in emotion, right? Mm-hmm. I was so relieved. That
and
was
you were just for the record, you were.
I'm sorry.
Your hand is up, and your other hand is down.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You're from way up here to way down there. That's okay.
Yes, my emotions were so high because I was so fearful for the lives of my soldiers. Okay.
Right.
And I had heard element, which meant an enemy element coming towards them, and they'd run across an elephant.
Uh-huh.
So there was my range of emotion. Just, right. I mean, this all happened in the course of a minute, if not less.
Right.
And so we all got a good laugh out of that. And then, of course, the writer being mm-hmm. there made a little story that he put into the Ivy League's news magazine about the big elephant.
Okay.
Sure did.
Okay. Did you ever run into any of the Pathet Lao troops from Laos or the Khmer?
We killed Chinese. To answer your question, to my knowledge, no. To your question.
Okay.
But again, and forgive me for looking away. Obviously, I'm thinking back when I look away from your eye contact, Richard. But because I start seeing these little scenes.
Right, right.
It's amazing. Because it's not where I go.
Right.
But I remember, I don't remember when it was, but another one of those contacts.
First tour?
Yeah, this is my first tour.
Okay.
First tour, yeah. And we had a pretty good firefight, and there were a lot of men. Well, I say a lot, I don't know how many, but mm-hmm. quite a few dead, I should say that way.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few dead. And I remember we wanted this was around the stream, and we got so annoyed just being humans because one guy was lying in the water and we wanted to refill our canteens there. And it's just one of those little fleeting emotional things as we were policing up the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I saw my first Chinese. I mean, they were demonstrably larger.
Is that what identified them?
Yeah, that's exactly. You knew immediately, hey, this is a horse here, you know,
mm-hmm.
versus these little guys. And there were two or three. I guess they were advisors. I'm sure they were advisors.
Mm-hmm.
They were obvious to us Chinese. You know, we took whatever we took and mm-hmm. turned into the S2 and all that. And I don't know anything past that. But that's the only time in my recollection, probably period,
mm-hmm.
that I saw that kind of a thing. And it was that one time
mm-hmm.
was the Chinese, big guys.
Okay.
But one of them was in the water. And it was messing with our water.
Did you go upstream of him to fill?
We dragged him out, obviously pulled him out of the water, but yeah, we did. We definitely needed that water.
Right. Go ahead.
But that's the one, relatively speaking, one exception to that kind of enemy.
Okay.
Yeah.
Were you wounded on your first tour?
I was blown up, hit a landmine, but not seriously wounded,
mm-hmm.
and it guarded me a Purple Heart.
Okay, what happened?
But we had two in a row. The first time it happened, we're riding along, and one of my lead APCs
mm-hmm.
ran over mine. And so I caused my guy to accelerate and pull up, and then of course I'm riding in the cupola, and I was off and running over there in a hurry because I was the next in line, and mm-hmm. everybody's behind me or forward of them, whichever.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned in short order was, my guys would look at me askance because I guess they're thinking I could detonate another mine. I mean, they weren't any personal. They were anti-tank mines, so they were a larger thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
But the uniqueness of that was, now I'm come back to is I had a similar situation happen. But I ran to them to lend assistance,
mm-hmm.
and found myself basically alone. And I want to share another one of those with you.
Okay.
And no one was seriously injured. I mean, obviously depends. And if you had a 500-pound bomb under there, there's nothing left,
mm-hmm.
you know. But their homemade devices or whatever that particular. I mean, it wasn't our standard anti-tank mine. It was just blowing M60 to the moon thing.
Right.
And that's what happened to me in a very like manner situation. You know, got cuts and bruises and that sort of thing, and blown out of the cupola, but nothing even like my dear friend whose son chose to be an infantryman years later and was in Israel on a field training exercise from Fort Washington for Fort Lewis with the 9th Division, and ran over a mine in his Jeep out there and lost his foot, you know, like in the 80s. Different story, but anyway, twice I got looked at it askance. If I may flash forward for a moment, second tour.
Sure.
In here is an award for a soldier's medal. I don't know how familiar you are with a soldier's medal, but it is a very special award, and it's for conditions, heroic conditions, not under hostile fire.
Mm-hmm.
But yet I got it in Vietnam. And on my second tour, we were up in Binh Dinh province in the mountains, heavy, high trees.
Mm-hmm.
And we hadn't been resupplied in a while, and we need to be resupplied.
How long had you been out?
Well, we never went in. I mean, okay. As a general rule, that's what I truly liked about the fourth. Now, this is my company now. I'm the second tour as a company commander.
Okay.
But the thing about the fourth, we always stayed in the bush. Now, there were exceptions, like when we went from Dok To back to the Iodrang, we stopped overnight in Camp Inouye for a night, as an example. But the 4th Division stayed in the bush, and that's something I want to give a profiling of at some point, of how grand and wonderful the 19-year-old infantryman was in Vietnam and what his life was in the field.
Mm-hmm.
But this is my second tour, and I'm literally on the side of a mountain, honestly. I don't mean honestly, but we had a big gorge here.
Mm-hmm.
The trees were still out about here in the chopper was real high,
mm-hmm.
but and I know they can't see it, but I'm just trying to give you the.
Mm-hmm.
So this was where we were going to have to receive our resupply, but they're going to have to drop it great distance, and then I'm literally holding on to a tree on the side like this, and the gorge bottom is here, and then they're dropping from up here.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd had a couple of three choppers come in and to drop resupply, and we were getting our little cases of soda.
Right.
Well, my God, by the time they were falling, the distance they were falling, we weren't getting three cans out of a case.
Mm-hmm.
So this one bird came in, and of course I'm talking to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Blackjack 6, Alpha 6 over, could you at least bring your skids down to treetop level? Because they were still dropping them well above the treetops even, you know?
Wow.
And there was a hole there that a chopper could fit in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I had one of my rear guys was on this particular bird,
mm-hmm.
from my rear,
mm-hmm.
a short timer that you send back, you know, give him mm-hmm. a break. And so I said, I just simply asked him if he would at least, we're losing too much of our stuff, if mm-hmm. he would at least come down to treetop level with the skids. Roger, I can do that, Alpha 6, you know, kind of a thing. Well, then he comes down to the hole, and I don't think I ever knew. I surely must have asked him, but I can't say either which way now.
Mm-hmm.
I've always wanted to think that he wanted to consciously come down in the hole, because there was sufficient. It was a little squirrely. In every pilot, you know, there are better ones than others, mm-hmm. and all that. And but anyway, he came down into the hole. He came down past the tree, mm-hmm. the tree tops, and then he lost RPM. So I don't know, I must have known it once, because either way, he lost RPM, and then when he swung that tailbone around, and the rotor hit the tree, and I'm up here, and I just watched that chopper fall to the gulch, to this gulch,
mm-hmm.
ravine. Well, once again, whether I'm a lieutenant or a captain, I'm on the run, Richard,
mm-hmm.
and I've got all my CP up here with me. I've got my medic, I've got my FO, I've got his RTO, and I've got two RTOs of my own,
mm-hmm.
all in my CP up here. But they're up on the top, and I'm hanging down here talking to the radio. Well, I go bounding down this very, very steep incline, and as I'm going down it, and I'm already thinking as a commander, what we need to do. I don't know that it's going to blow up. I don't know how many people's hurt.
Mm-hmm.
My medic should be right behind me with his medic bag. All these things mm-hmm. is going through my mind as I'm going down.
Mm-hmm.
And as I get down to the bottom, and I mean the chopper's on its side, it's still kind of settling. I literally, so help me Lord, I turn around to start giving orders, and there ain't a soul there.
Okay.
I look up the hill, and there's this is what they're saying to them, says, "Dummy, Captain, I don't think so." So in other words, they were saying, I can't speak for them, but they were saying, hey, because I'd done one of these numbers as I started down the hill, come on, let's go get these guys.
Mm-hmm.
But they were saying, we're smarter than that. If that thing blows up, we're safe. I mean, I'm sure that's what they were thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it didn't take long for me to get their attention because now it's settled
mm-hmm.
and it isn't blowing up. There's no fire. And, of course, they came on down.
Right.
And we got them out. And nobody was seriously hurt. We had to, take the radios and everything off the chopper. And then I got to blow it up. Well, back then, it doesn't sound like much today, but they cost $250,000. That's what they cost then.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I did, I had a lieutenant that was very good with demolitions.
Mm-hmm.
And we rigged it. You know, of course, it still had all of its fuel in it, essentially,
mm-hmm.
but was gutted as far as the basics.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I imagine somebody came out, some safety guy came out, and I don't know, but a day or two later, we were ready to blow it up. And so I chose me to be the guy to blow it up. And so we just had so much chorus, so I was able to get what I thought was a fair distance or a comfortable
mm-hmm.
distance from it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'm also behind a big old log that's lying horizontal to the ground. And so that's what I got behind, and then I pushed, I got everybody's way, because this is down in the, and everybody's up here anyway. Anyway, I pushed the plunger to fire that thing off.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, I'm talking about a ball of fire come blowing towards me with all that fuel and stuff.
Right.
Man, I got down like this, and I mean a ball of fire blew over me like you've never seen before. Almost blew myself up. But I didn't get hurt. I think I got singed, it seems like, with my eyebrows.
Lost your eyebrows.
No big deal. Yeah. But out of that, of course, with my guys put me in, I received a soldier's medal for my response to
mm-hmm.
that particular circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Question?
No. Why don't we take a break for a second?
Okay.
Let me ask you about enemy tactics. Can you describe what you saw, what was the most common way that they attacked, or in general, and if there needs to be discrepancies between the BC and the NVA tactics? Could you explain that? And what, in general, did you see as how they would come at you, or did they lay more an ambush for you to come at them?
Okay. Well, as said earlier, Richard, I can't speak to any degree regarding the Viet Cong.
Right.
My experience was with the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've also said earlier, right or wrong, I didn't have... I was never involved in a major, brigade size fight that lasted for days. I think very few of us did, but
mm-hmm.
I didn't have that experience. So for the most part, as we've said so often about the enemy in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
they were, for the most part, an unseen enemy.
Right.
Okay. But yet they were there,
mm-hmm.
and they did understand how to fight their war. And they, almost like the Indians in our Cowboys movies, they picked and chose the time they wanted to fight for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they obviously were more in a defensive role in that they did pick and choose, and they often did their ambushes. And this is the very subject that I have spent a lot of time, literally the last year or so, reflecting on. As we get older, we reflect. And interestingly, in my time, in my second tour from December of 69 to July of 70, as a rifle company commander, I had less contact. Of course, the war wasn't quite as violent at that point, but I had less contact during that year than I did my first year.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't question it at the time, why this was, and this isn't absolute, but I think maybe it is in my own mind. It is because I very much was a disciplined commander, and I cared for my soldiers. Not that others didn't, of course, but they were first and foremost in my mind, and so I did not suffer principle ever that I consciously ever would do that to endanger their lives. Reflect back for a moment. This was my second tour also. We were in the mountains. We stayed in the mountains a lot in my second tour. This was a rainy season. We had literally spent the better part of a day circumventing a mountain. I don't know why we were assigned to go up on the mountain, but I mean on a high mountain in a monsoon. And we had spent a good part of the day doing that.
It's company size?
Yes. Okay. My company. We're on top of a mountain. The wind is blowing. The rain is pouring. We set up in our little ponchos. I mean, we hook ponchos to ponchos and best you can try to get by. And I'm in my little hooch with one of my radio operators.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep hearing this noise. Guys talking. And I basically said, who in the hell is that? And, you know, my guys, well, it was my Alabama squad. I had some boys from Alabama. One of them got shot a while after that. And as I was helping put him on the aircraft, on the Huey, he said, kill some of the bastards for me, Captain. And he was shot at that time. And that's what he was still saying. His rucksack was smoking. I mean, he had gotten shot when I was putting him on the plane. But it was this group of guys. And oftentimes you'd find your best field soldiers are your sorriest rear soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
They're great in the field, but they can't. They're not too controlled in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this group of Alabama boys were.
Mm-hmm.
And that's who was talking. And they were 30 meters forward, whatever, around the perimeter, because I'm in the center.
Mm-hmm.
So I had my radio guy call and tell him to knock it off. 10 minutes later, same old smoking and joking.
Mm-hmm.
So, one more time. And maybe I went through the platoon or whatever. I said, but knock it off. Now, here's my responsibility as a commander, Richard.
Mm-hmm.
These young boys, sitting on top of a mountain, in the middle of the night, there ain't any billy goats up there, mountain goats up there, you know. Just us dumb Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So they felt they're safe and sound.
Mm-hmm.
But you and I know better. And I have a responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So after the second, and they really think they're safe. I don't know that they're safe. And I know my responsibility. So after the second time of calling over there, sometime later, same old stuff. I really didn't want to get out in the rain. It's pouring. It's nasty.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on the top. It's blowing. I got out of my little hooch. I walked over to where they were in their little poncho thing. And I reached down and I just ripped it off and dropped it. And there they were, all sitting in there. You know, just young boys enjoying each other's company, etc.
I guess, are you lucky that they didn't shoot?
I never thought about that. I've never thought about that.
Okay.
But I think it happened quickly enough.
They
knew who. I mean, I may have said something as I did, you know, whatever. But the point is, I tore that thing off, and there they sit. And I didn't say a word. I just returned to my little hooch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess the point of my story is, I sleep very well at night knowing that those men, although one got shot later, that those guys are going to go to bed tonight with their wives and see their grandkids tomorrow because of my dedication or my efforts for their well-being. Could I have let that slide? Sure, I could have let it slide. But that's not the way I operate. That's not what I'm charged to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one of my little stories about that. That's not a direct answer back to your question. But going back to the unseen enemy, again on my second tour, we were leaving a night position one time and very, very thick vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
And the drag platoon, the last guy that was moving out there, and I was back in that area because I always made sure that we left it, and we didn't leave anything for the enemy. Because mm-hmm. you can leave your old wet socks. You don't want to hump them. And that's socks for Charlie. Mm-hmm. And so we don't leave a seed ration can. That's the makings of a booby trap. Mm-hmm. So, but as a commander, I have that responsibility. I mean, I'm using my chain of command, but mm-hmm. I want it right. Mm-hmm. So I happened to be back there when this guy turned around. He was literally the last guy in all of this company movement. He turns around, and this is thick, thick vegetation. And he takes a picture of his buddy. And then weeks and weeks later, because, I mean, at some point he takes it up, he's got to get it back to the rear, get it developed, and back out. Mm-hmm. He's looking at his pictures. And he gets to that picture that I just described. Mm-hmm. And in the vegetation back in there, is a bad guy face.
Oh my gosh. Really?
Looking at it. So help me. I saw it. Now, going back to the tactics, and I say they're unseen enemy. But so help me, that was captured just that simple, just like that.
That's a bit spooky.
Yes, sir. Now, my reflection when I said my second tour, mm-hmm. we had our little moments, but mm-hmm. nothing like the first time. And I reflected on that. And this is going to be, I don't mean it really as an attaboy personally to Jim Wheeler, because it's unproven, but I think the point is well made. The bad guys did, for the most part, because they, generally speaking, couldn't mass a force necessary to attack a company. Mm-hmm. So they mostly worked in a defensive hit-and-run kind of mode. Mm-hmm. Well, I've come to the conclusion, and I've really spent a lot of time with this, a very serious mm-hmm. point I'm going to make, and maybe this will end this for now, is as I reflected why we didn't have more contact, yet I was never ambushed either time, personally. But so help me. The next day after I turned over my recon platoon, I got to go to be the S3 Air for a short while before I left Vietnam, my first tour at the battalion. The first day that the new lieutenant, or the lieutenant that took over my platoon, mm-hmm. got ambushed and took an RPG through the right front of the APC and killed my driver. And I was on the LZ when they brought him in. Okay. Yet I've been out there almost 9 months. So I must be, God is on my side. Mm-hmm. A little bit of luck in life, mm-hmm. but I'm not doing dumb things. Mm-hmm. Okay. So what I've arrived at, Richard, is by employing the proper tactics, using my point, using my flank security, using my rear security, not hip-hopping down trails, not trying to avoid Charlie. I look for Charlie every day. Oh, God, I did. But by not putting myself in an ambush situation, not mm-hmm. that it couldn't happen, mm-hmm. luck too, I've come to believe that I did a very good job in employing my troops the way I did. Because every day I search for Charlie, I never once... Ever. It's not even in my vocabulary. Tried to not find him or not go somewhere. And there's some stuff went on over there. It's an imperfect world we live in. Mm-hmm. And I did my job, and I think I did it well. It's really not about me, but that's what I've arrived at as mm-hmm. I've really reflected on it, that I must have done some things right there because I never got ambushed. And that was by working by primarily a little instinct, but also by the book. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I've come to a very pleasant feeling about that.
So in my question of the nature of the enemy and their tactics, you reflect upon just how you and your men reacted to what was there every day and what you came across or what you went out to find. They weren't necessarily taking the war to you. Is that what I'm hearing?
No, they rarely take the war to you. Unless you are in a weaker position, because like in any in any line of resistance, where you're going to attack at the weakest point. Well, you've got to find the weakest point. And I'm mm-hmm. saying, in a sense, that I didn't, that I employed it well, and I'm not trying to be, do me. That's not the point whatsoever.
There were a few weak points in your line when you were in command where they couldn't attack, perhaps.
True. And that's not to say, again, I'm blessed, but I mean, mm-hmm. That's not to say that I was ignorant to a spider hole here where we walked right over. I
right.
walked right past a tunnel.
Right.
A tunnel complex. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, he generally picked and chose where the fight was to be enjoined.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I guess, as I'm saying, in my estimation, I made that decision for him because he was going to have to play with me just like we do that pickup game on the weekend with the Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
Straight up.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't muster that.
Maybe perhaps that's why there was a bounty on your head.
Maybe so. But here's my head.
Right. Why don't we go ahead and stop for the day?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome.